Today is Monday, October 12th, 2020. This is a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Kim Johnson, J-O-H-N-S-O-N. And my name is Tom Martin. Good morning, Kim. How are you today?
Hi, Tom. I'm doing well.
Great. Kim, may we have your permission to record this oral history interview over the telephone?
Yes.
Thank you. I'd kind of like to start off, what year were you born?
1956.
And where were you born? What were your folks doing there?
Here on South Dakota, my mom was a homemaker and would become a teacher when I was older. And my father, at the time I was born, my father had Johnson Tractor, which was the Ford and tractor implement dealership in Huron, South Dakota. So it was a business that he'd had with his father.
Wow. Oh, yeah. That's neat. So serving the farming community there?
Yeah.
Okay. Did you have any brothers and sisters?
No.
Okay. And did you grow up there in South Dakota?
We moved several times, and then probably from the age of 7 through high school, I was in Florissant, which is a suburb of St. Louis, Missouri.
All right. Did you all do the normal summer holiday in the station wagon kind of thing?
Yeah, I think so. Though now that you say that, it's not like we went to national parks or anything. When I was young, we went with the cousins to a lake in South Dakota. I have memories of that outdoors. And I think, that's a funny question. I can't quite remember where we went. But, yeah, I definitely have memories of, you know, standing between my parents in the station wagon in the front seat, no seat belt, nothing, you know.
Right.
All that, and my father drank a beer, and
uh-huh.
All those things that never would happen anymore these days.
Right, right. And is that where you learned to swim in the lakes in South Dakota?
I probably learned to swim more than swimming lessons. I don't remember too much about that. I was in the swim team when I was young, maybe 7, 8, 9.
Wow.
We had a country club and swim team was, you know, a fun activity for kids for summer.
Yeah. Did you swim in high school?
Well, you know, I graduated in 1974. We didn't have girls' athletics until my senior year of high school.
Oh, wow. Okay.
I got to be the announcer for the boys' diving team. And then our last year, they finally decided to have a girls' swim team.
Wow. Did you get on that team?
Yeah. Yeah.
Did you like swimming then?
Oh, yeah.
Great.
I liked swimming a lot.
And did you, you know, on the weekends, did you pal around with your friends out in the country at all? I mean, you're living in the suburbs, so
it was a very much of a suburban neighborhood, and, you know, suburban life, and I was in scouts, and I had started the outdoor club at my school, but my parents didn't hike or do any of that kind of stuff, so we did typical weekends. pretty typical. But very suburban, right?
But wow, you started an outdoor club in high school?
I did.
That's pretty neat. How'd you get that idea?
Well, I'm not sure. I mean, we had clubs, and I remember the electronics teacher was kind enough to be our faculty advisor. And we did a bike tour from St. Louis, and it must have been either in the late spring or early fall. And we all rode our bikes over to this campground near the river in Illinois. And in the middle of the night, it was so freaking full of mosquitoes.
Ooh.
the faculty advisor said, and it was hot, said, "See ya, I'm leaving," and abandoned all of us in the mosquito-laden swampland there.
Yikes.
Yeah.
Back in the day, no seatbelts. Yep.
Right.
Wow, no chaperones. See you later. Oh my gosh. Were you thinking about going to college in high school? Is that something you were thinking of doing? Was it expected, I guess, of you from your parents?
Oh yeah. There was no doubt that I'd go to college.
Okay.
And that said,
yeah,
I ended up at Prescott College, which you probably have talked to other Prescott College people that have a Grand Canyon connection, right?
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah. Yeah, so I learned about Prescott College from the World Encyclopedia yearbook. It had a little article about it. And
wow.
Yeah, I thought that was the coolest thing since sliced bread. What my parents should have done was, in the summer, sent me on an Outward Bound trip and then said, "Now you come home and go to University of Missouri." Because Prescott, the semester I got there by December was in bankruptcy.
Ooh.
And so I called my parents in December and said, "Well, I'm coming back early. The college is bankrupt." And actually, that was my segue to the Grand Canyon, because one of the guys who had been a researcher, who had been a professor at Prescott, ran one of the research labs. And so in January, rather than going back to college, I went and worked and lived at Grand Canyon. That's probably why I lived in the hospital, come to think of it. And I worked in that research lab. I had a free internship, unpaid internship set up. So I worked for them, and then by that summer, we were doing a project. At that time, it was in the middle of, so this would have been 1975, and the Park Service was in the middle of working on the river management plan, and the park really wanted to discontinue the use of the portable toilets, which were buried on the beaches. So somebody said, "Well, let's do an epidemiological study and try to decide if it's a health hazard or not to bury chemical toilet waste on beaches."
Hey, Kim, hang on a second. Let's back up a little bit. When I think of Prescott College, I think of the first semester. The first few weeks of the first semester is typically some sort of, as you mentioned, an Outward Bound type of...
Exactly, yeah. And mine was in New Mexico, and that's the big deal of what I was interested in, and my folks should have just said, "Fine, go to Outward Bound, and then you come home and go to a regular college."
Right. Prescott College in New Mexico, was that like, you know, see you later here, the mosquitoes kind of thing? What was that like?
Oh, that was a great trip. We had, I don't know, we probably had 10 students and a leader and a co-leader that were just, you know, too cool for school, and we backpacked. I don't know, 10 days maybe. It was a great trip. I exactly what I wanted to do.
And was that your first time west?
Oh yeah, yeah. I think I had been in probably no further west than South Dakota.
Wow. Okay.
I mean, you know, it's a typical thing. You're very brave. You really want to go to the big bad west. My parents put me on the bus to ride the Greyhound bus out to Arizona to go to college. And, you know, you think you're all brave and here and watch me go. And the bus pulls away from the bus station and you're in tears, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I was barely 18. So anyway.
Gosh. But it sounds like they bundled you up and took you out to New Mexico and you put on a backpack and that was great.
Yeah, yeah.
Nice. Did you make other friends that fall at Prescott College that you're still in contact with?
Not in contact with. I mean, Prescott College is such a, you know, I remember going there. It's such an unusual place and had very interesting people. I remember getting there and being one of the only people that was still shaving their legs. You know, it was very much of a hippy-dippy college. And I remember meeting, I don't know if she was my roommate or what, but she had a boa constrictor that was her pet that was always wrapped around her neck and her very voluptuous bosom, which would just torture the guys whenever they saw her. And I remember being in downtown Prescott with her, and she was from Wenatchee or somewhere in Washington. Well, was a barrel racer, right? And she was always, like, walking around when we were downtown and, like, spitting in the gutter. I'm like, what the hell? And then she finally was showed me that she was chewing flutes, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Huh. So it was a good beginning of an education for you.
Yeah, right.
Nice.
Well, I think that's the case when every kid goes to college.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's true. I'm curious, who was the professor that you linked in with that was running the research labs?
Yeah, it was Roy Johnson.
Okay. What can you tell me about Roy? Would have been Dr. Johnson, I guess.
Yeah, he was a... God, I don't not remember his specialty. He had seen the writing on the wall with Prescott. He'd had a hassle of kids. He took the job at the Park Service. He left it and went somewhere like NIH, or I don't remember. I don't remember as much about him as the guy that I ended up in the summer, I guess before we got really involved in the research, there was another guy named Peter somebody or other who was also in that research lab who was doing a lot of research on fire prescriptions. And I worked for a field research team on the North Rim, and he was quite the character. That research lab didn't really continue. I don't think it continued to be funded, but we laid a shit ton of coax cable on the North Rim and did some prescribed burns and, you know, watched the heat and measured soil depth and the usual stuff. So.
Okay. So I'm just trying to work out the timeline and march along here. So you went through your orientation, kind of Prescott College, a couple weeks out in the field, and then some didactic work, but the school was going to go bankrupt. They did recover from that.
They did.
But it sounds like you ended up in the spring of 75.
Yeah, I live here at Grand Canyon, south of. I think I lived at the South Rim and worked in the research lab, and then in the summer, that summer I got a seasonal job, went to the North Rim, worked that seasonal job for that research unit, and then I think I came back. I think I maybe got hired as a seasonal for the research. I don't remember quite. But
okay.
That's kind of probably in 76. I think that's how I first got down the river, because we were doing the research project. And we went on a one-boat motor trip in January with, you probably talked to Steve Carruthers, right?
Not yet, but that may happen soon here.
Yeah.
What do you remember about that trip, besides being cold?
Yeah, right? So that was a great trip. I mean, now in hindsight, kind of never would have done a one-boat trip in the wintertime, but we had a 22-foot snout boat, which Steve let me row quite a bit, which was great. You know, I had pretty lousy gear. I was wearing a raincoat. Colder than hell. There's no light, and I loved it. Right? It was a great trip.
Nice. So, let's go back a little bit. That summer of 75, or I guess the spring of 75, you leave Prescott, you go to the South Rim. I'm the research lab. I'm just thinking of the Science Center. Did Roy set up some sort of a a lab somewhere on the South Rim, or were you working out of the Science Center? How did that work?
I don't remember exactly where our facility was. I want to say it was in the, some of the offices in the Visitor Center.
Okay.
And that's where we hatched the research plan to do the research on the portable toilet site.
And did you get on the river to do that?
Yeah.
So was that your first river trip then? Would have been in the summer of 75 to look at the portable toilets?
No, my first trip was January of...
January. 76. Okay.
Yeah.
So that spring, looking at how do... back at the time where we were talking about 15,000 river runners a year, how does their solid waste impact the canyon?
Well, so that was a big deal because you've probably talked to Steve and you talked to Kurt. I think you said you talked to Marvin, right? Marv Jensen.
I did a little bit, but we didn't do a full interview like this.
Well, the Park Service... I got your dog in this fight. The Park Service really wanted the motors off the river.
Okay.
And nobody could wrap their hands around, nobody could wrap their hands around the idea. Let me back up. What everybody did at that time was they put a chemical-based portable toilet, and then the effluent from that was put in a hole every day at every beach. So theoretically, every beach had a load of effluent buried on it. And I think we were kind of like ginning up to see how we would justify saying, no, you got to carry all the solid waste out of the canyon.
Mm-hmm.
I think what was happening at the same time is everybody else was sort of saying, for the motors and for the rubber rafts, it's no big deal. The only people in the commercial side that would have had a problem with it were the dories, and the dories figured it out. They just added in a baggage boat that carried them the ammo cans, and everybody kind of easily shifted over. So this study was really kind of not a lark, but we didn't exactly need it to make that requirement be palatable and well received by the commercial outfitters. So.
Right.
But got me a lot of river trips. So.
Yeah, I did a really nice interview with Steve Martin. And he talked about that transition and how that was it was a simple thought for a while. Hey, we're going to use this chemical toilet and we're going to dig a hole, we're going to bury it. But with Glen Canyon Dam upstream, the seasonal scouring flows were gone, and the beaches were turning into piles of blue goo.
Well, it wasn't that bad. If you knew where to look and where things were typically buried, you could uncover them.
Okay.
But the research study was really pretty hilarious because we were going back, and every trip we'd go back and we'd visit these sites, and we would pull out core samples, and we would test for a couple of different types of bacteria, one of which was an anaerobic anthrax.
Okay.
Fairly deadly bacteria. But to test for it, to culture for it, we would have to use these canisters that would create an anaerobic environment. And the only reason why I sort of got on this project was because in high school I'd had enough classes in microbiology. I went to kind of an advanced school, but you could do a fairly intensive thing. So I had a fair amount of microbiological technique, and I could handle the lab work.
Nice.
So we would sit down there on the river with our pipettes, and the river raft guys just thought this was hilarious. So, anyway, yeah. If you go way back, did you ever talk to Richard Ox and the publication Sama?
No. How do you spell his last name?
You should run him down. O-C-H-S, Richard Ox. I think I have that right.
O-T-H-S.
O-C-H-S. O-C-H-S.
O-C-H-S.
He was the publisher of a newspaper for guests and for employees called the Grand Canyon Sama, S-A-M-A. And there's a picture of my friend and I, you know, sitting on the beach doing a little science thing. That picture might also be in Butch Farabee's, one of Butch Farabee's books. But you've talked to Butch, haven't you?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway.
And yeah. What was Richard? So Richard was running this microbio experiment. He was kind of overseeing that, or was he?
No, Richard. I think Richard worked for the Grand Canyon Historical Society, or something.
Okay.
Or the Natural History Association, or I don't remember. He published that paper. That paper was a general paper and covered everything from, you know, what's going on in the park today, or I don't know, highlights of Richard Euler's research. I don't remember too much about it.
Okay. All right. Okay. So what you're trying to look for, it sounds like, is the breakdown, the biohazard breakdown of solid waste,
right.
buried with a bunch of chemicals,
mm-hmm.
to take care of the odor mostly, in sand, that has water inundation going up and down because of the bridge or the dam, I suppose.
Maybe
not.
Would have been dry.
Okay.
They would have been above the, everybody was camping above the Tamarisk line.
Mm.
And in 1983, there were no releases that were over the Tamarisk line.
Right. 83 was the exception.
Yeah.
To prove the 1975 or 76 rule, there when everything went belly up for a little bit. Okay. What were your parents thinking about this time? They're like, wait a minute, you're supposed to be in school. Were they supportive of your?
I think, I think they were supportive. I think they were a little bit both relieved and horrified. It was a private school, and I don't know how sending me to 4 more years of that would have been affordable. I think they were kind of like, oh, yeah, well, you do what you want to do. You know, I'm sure that, I mean, in hindsight, I did what 18-year-olds do, which is like left and never looked back.
Right.
But I was still a child, and now, you know, I'm parent, well, grandparent age, and I'm sure that just left a huge hole in their lives, and I was pretty oblivious to it, as 18-year-olds are, so.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's a very, very good point. So the spring and summer, and into that fall, so basically most of 1975, you were working out of the South Rim then?
I think in the summer of 75, I was working on the North Rim.
Got it, thank you.
And then I think by the summer of 76, I was working for the South Rim research, whatever the heck it lab was. Yeah, research lab.
And what did you do over the winter of 75, 76?
I think I was... Good question. I think I was working for the Park Service as a seasonal for that research lab.
Okay.
I might have spent some time... I ended up back going to college a little bit at University of Washington. I might have spent some time in Seattle, but I sort of can't remember when that actually was. So.
Okay. Do you remember any of the other people that you were working with at the time then, 75, 76?
Well, the Nancy Whiteman worked with me on that research project. I don't know if she, that's her, that was her maiden name. We ended up probably in 76, 77, starting to be close with the river guys who worked for Oars. I eventually ended up looking for them. You know, I think, I was probably friends with a lot of people that were in the park at that time, but nobody really stands out in particular.
Okay. All right. And so in 76, so let's go back to that January one boat trip with Steve Carruthers.
Yeah.
Was that a couple week long trip then?
Yeah, it was probably 12, 13 days.
So fast enough.
Yeah.
To Diamond Creek?
I think we had a small motor on that. It was a 22-foot snout.
Okay.
And I think we may have also had a small motor. I can't remember completely.
Do you remember who else was on that trip?
A friend of Carruthers, who was quite the character. He might have been a boatman for somebody. I don't remember his name, though. Roy Johnson was on that trip. And then I don't remember who else.
And what do you remember about Steve?
Well, you know, I mean, Steve Carruthers is kind of a larger-than-life character. I don't know if you know him. Well, it sounds like you haven't talked to him yet. Still is one of the preeminent avian biologists in the Southwest, and ended up, I think he ran the Museum of Northern Arizona. I think that's who he was working for at the time. He is extremely charismatic, led a lot of people into science, led a lot of people into their PhDs and their careers in science. He's a very, very impressive, person. I felt very privileged, to work with him and felt like I had his respect somewhat. He let me row his boat. So I was rowing one day and I took a stroke and I broke the handle off the oar.
Ooh.
And he was pretty impressed by that. I'm sure that was just,
Oh my gosh. That makes me think two things. You were very strong, or the gear wasn't that good.
The gear was probably pretty good. I'm pretty good size, and I'm sure it just was a point of weakness. I've never seen it happen since then.
Yeah.
But, no, I mean the stuff was good. He had a good rig and good equipment. He always had good equipment.
Uh huh. Good. And what was the purpose of that trip again in January?
I think Steve had some research. He was doing quite a bit of natural science research. The Park Service was about to let out a lot of contracts to scientists all over the country. That was to be the science that was to underwrite the overall, carrying capacity of Grand Canyon. So he may have had biological research that he was doing. There's a lot of basic science, and we ended up, over several years, we took down, I want to say, every kind of student scientist in the world from guys that were doing research on the sand migration and deep stabilization, disk stabilization, botanists. We took the archaeologists down. We took a guy that was a herpetologist.
Okay.
Which is just hilarious. Funny story on that. The guy was as bald as a lizard, not even any hair on his arms. And at that time, in natural science, you had to catch a specimen to verify your data. I caught this specimen at this
right
type of place, so you had to kill it. So we had just a chest of drawers full of dead animals. And so that trip, we were down on the lake, and we've been... They've been collecting rattlesnakes and all kinds of stuff. And the rattlesnakes in Grand Canyon are those little Grand Canyon kinks, and by and large, they're pretty docile, and they're fairly small, right?
Right.
So, kind of like after dinner or something, and the herpetologists go out, and there's been, yeah, some snakes, they bring back a snake bag, you know, like they do, and we all gather around, and these guys take the snake bag, and they dump it out on the sand. It's not a little tiny Grand Canyon snake, it's a huge Mojave diamondback, and the thing's about 6.5 feet long, and it comes up snarling, they're laughing their asses off, we're running for the hills, it was hilarious.
Oh my gosh. How many trips did you get a chance to do that year of 1976?
You know, I want to say I maybe did 6 or 8.
All right. Which is a lot.
Yeah.
And were you meeting the other people working for the Park Service? Kurt hadn't shown up yet. I'm trying to think of who else would have been.
I think Marv and Steve would be running the river unit, I think.
Right. I think that's right.
Yeah.
What do you remember about Marv Jensen?
You know, I cannot cut broccoli. I have no idea. Marv was a very gracious, lovely, considerate, incredible leader. I remember him as low talking, but very much in charge, very, very wise, and great family man. So he was LDS. I'm not sure if that matters. But I remember we were in the kitchen. We're cutting dinner, you know, vegetables for dinner. Like, do I think he's going to stop fucking broccoli? Like, yeah, Marv, thank you, man, for doing it. I don't know. He was just a dynamo man. Wonderful respect for him.
Nice. Any other things you remember about those river trips in 76?
Yeah, I mean, I think by that time they're starting to put us out on commercial trips, and we went down with oars.
Okay.
And then my husband ended up dating one of the boatmen, started dying, whom she married, and then I got pulled into the oars organization, and that's where I think, you know, you probably read Kevin Fidarko's book and the famous Georgie, you know, they don't make passengers like they used to,
mm-hmm.
story. So, Terry was in on that. You know, that's a very famous Grand Canyon story. And I started doing a lot more rowing on those trips, and then I ended up in 77 working as a commercial guide in California for all the time, and somewhere along the line, I got some trips in the trainee with oars. Well, I started working, you know, as a boatman in that era.
For oars.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And then 76, 77, it sounds like you might have gone back to a little bit of schooling in there?
Somewhere in there. I stuck my head in college back at University of Washington, but I just cannot remember what it was.
Okay. And then back to Grand Canyon for another summer season.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
In 1978.
Yeah. And then somewhere in there, I started working both as a commercial guide for oars, and then by that time, the Park Service, the research trips were really kind of starting to pick up, and we were starting to do trips that were both patrol trips and then, you know, we took every kind of dog and cat researcher down the Grand Canyon,
mm-hmm.
to do that work. So we were kind of like a raft company for the researchers.
Okay. Who else were you rowing with? Who else do you remember were some of the other guides you were working with?
Yeah, you know, some of these people that just start, Sam West was a commercial guide for oars and then came to work for the Park Service.
What can you tell me about Sam?
Sam very interesting person. He was very kind, very much of a student of Buddhism. Tim Crumbo was around at that time, I think. And, Sam and I ended up somewhere in there. We talked the Park Service into letting us run kayak patrols, and Sam and I did a couple of solo trips in kayaks, which he didn't have much experience kayaking. I had a fair amount, but so we ran two or three kayak trips, I think.
Okay, wait. Let's put this in reverse and back up a little bit. How did you get introduced to kayaking?
Yeah, so I must have college in there somewhere because I learned to kayak at the University of Washington.
Ah.
I must have been in the winter. The University of Washington had a pretty good kayak club.
Okay.
And, it must have been 76, 5, 7, those winters in there because I built the kayak and did some boating in Oregon and Washington State and then started doing, we did patrol trips and started throwing kayaks on patrol trips and stuff.
Okay. What was that like? So there's just two of you, two kayaks, you're doing self-support.
Well, that was a hell of a deal because we went down and we cast food in plastic barrels. And
so Kim, it's getting kind of hard to hear you. Is there something happening? Can you don't abandon the phone? I guess.
Is that any better?
Yeah.
Yeah. So we cast barrels off to the Grand Canyon with food, but at that time, Hawkins probably had 15 outfitters, and the way those concessionaire contracts are constructed, the commercial outfitters have to be inspected by a park employee every year.
Right.
So, from the kayak, we would go and inspect the commercial companies. Now, most of the owners were very smart, and they knew that it was good to get that inspection done, and it was also good to be nice to the park rangers. So,
yeah.
We had this ridiculous situation where we'd go down the river, and we would see a commercial company, and we'd go, through West. Well, it's steak night. They can't cook very well, but we know that menu. It's usually pretty good. Let's see if they'll let us stay with them. So basically, we most nights stayed with a commercial company, and we do a little dog and pony show about the park service, and eat with them and eat breakfast, and then go off and try and figure out who we wanted to eat with the next night. It wasn't a scam. We really did do the inspections and
right.
Lower our stuff, but the outfitters, the guides usually got a bonus if they had a good inspection, so we'd be boating along, and the motor outfit could carry blenders. So I remember one day one of the boatmen hands down to me like a blueberry smoothie, like, hey, here.
Wow, okay. So it was self-support without the food.
Yeah, I mean, we probably could have made it going from our cash supply to cash supply.
Mm-hmm.
But we didn't have to.
But didn't need to. And when was the first time you did that? Do you remember?
I don't. It might have been more like in the 80s when I was actually a seasonal and part of the river unit or the river subdistrict, whichever it was. Don't know.
Okay. Yeah, that would make more sense because I think Sam, when did Sam transition to start working for the river unit at the park?
I don't remember. I don't remember. Crumble, Mary Lou, Sam, and then JT, Don Thomas came in later, and I just don't remember when all those people started with Park. So,
okay. Was that J.T. Reynolds?
No, John Thomas was a. John Thomas worked both as a river ranger, and then moved into resources management, as I recall.
Okay. All right. So in that time now, we're sort of talking 79, 80, 81.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned the Park Service back in the 70s, mid-70s, with Marv Jensen.
Mm-hmm.
We're looking at the spectrum of commercial use and the type of use that they wanted to have on the river, which...
Yeah, I mean, Marv may have. So what happened was, the river management plan, as the park wanted it, with the commercial allocation and the commercial and non-commercial split and no more motors, that plan was voted on all the way through Congress, I want to say 80 or prior. And then there was an amendment offered by Orrin Hatch that was, as I recall, a funding amendment that said, and if this management plan as is allowed to be effectuated, there will be no funding for the entire Department of the Interior, which was effectively Orrin Hatch's way of saying, no, yeah, you take that management plan and shove it,
mm-hmm.
which is effectively what happened. Motors weren't banned. And did Steve talk to you about that at all?
I don't think we talked too much about it.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm sure the people in the park who were very much for the let's get all the boaters off the river plan, they were very disappointed by the political nature of it all, and the non-commercials were pissed because their allocation didn't get increased, and that's a real defeat when you're carefully crafted a public hearing and so on and so forth, management plan gets derailed by a political mover from the Senate, that's a big deal. So.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, it's an issue that the Park Service is not free of at all kinds of service units all across the country.
Right.
Is political and financial pressures from business, from the business community. Did you have any personal thoughts about it at the time? What were the other people thinking? Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I think in some ways the commercial allocation, some of that should have been shifted back over to the private sector. I think at the end of the day, there was an awful lot of research that said, it doesn't really have anything to do with the number of people down here. It's how the heck they behave.
Yeah.
That has an impact. And even the thing that might have been pivotal on keeping the overall numbers of users down would have been the social experience. And Bo Shelby out of Oregon, University of Oregon, his research didn't support that. Nobody was saying, two people a day is fine, or two other commercial parties a day is fine, but three, that's too much. So there wasn't any research support for it. As far as the issue of motors, one of the things that, I should have been for getting motors off the river, but effectively, when you've got whatever the split is for motors and oars, you've got a way for commercial companies to space themselves out. So had they shifted everybody to oar-powered, there's the places in the Grand Canyon where everybody wants to go to the same place. And so 4 to 5 o'clock, everybody's starting to look for the same campsite. Well, if you've got a motor company, the boatmen can all get together and say, okay, you can motor 10 miles. We can't. You go get that campsite. And logistically, it helps, in my mind, smooth out the use of the river. And people ask me, what kind of trip should I go on? And I always try to push them to a 2-week long oar-powered trip, but on the other hand, you know, some people, if their only experience is a five-day motorized trip to part of the Grand Canyon,
mm-hmm.
you know, it's better that they had that experience. So I wasn't terribly unhappy in general with how all that turned out.
Uh-huh. Okay. And then at what point did you start working for the Park Service? So you've been working seasonally.
I think in 1980, and then somewhere along the line, I got hired as a 10-month Park Service technician. That was probably 1980-ish.
Okay.
So.
And was that MPS technician, was that with the River Unit?
Yeah.
And so, what was your job with them? Do you remember what your duties were?
Yeah, you know, I ended up doing a lot of. We all worked as a team to sort of do raft patrol, and I remember one of my big objectives was to take the stinking non-commercial river permit application and make it go from 9 pages. To 3 and get rid of all the gobbledygook and stupid questions that were really none of our business that would evaluate whether or not a person should be given a permit. So, you know, that was some office work. And the other thing I did that was super fun, I organized a training seminar for commercial guys and, you know, pulled that off for several seasons. And that was fun to pull together. It was fun to do, and you know, felt good about that work.
So let's hang on a second before we go any further. Let's open that one up a little bit. Had that been done before, or was this the first time that was happening?
I think I started that, or we started that. I don't know.
What do you remember about it?
Well, we had a hell of a party, and one night we got Robert Euler mad because all the river guys were up partying and he couldn't go to sleep. No,
was this at the South Rim or was it on the river? Where was this?
Yeah, on the river.
Okay.
It was a good deal. I mean, I got somebody to come and do a first aid refresher. I think we might have done a public health refresher, like. Trying not to give everybody giardia. I got everybody and their brother to come on the river and give lectures, and it was just a thrill. At the time, I was pretty into geology, and I remember I got Ivo Lukita,
uh-huh.
who was a very charismatic plate tectonics researcher for the USGS, who had one of the more interesting formation theories about Grand Canyon, that was very controversial and very like, what? So he came down, and so I had every kind of rock, bird, archaeology. Because if you say, hey, you want to go on a river trip and teach rap guy stuff? Uh-huh. So, and we would run it as a river trip, and you know, it was great fun, but I also thought that it was real good level education for guys.
Yep. Yeah, okay. There were a couple old-timers that came out to those. One of them was a guy from Indiana named Steve Fulmer. Actually, at the time, he might have been living in Phoenix. And he had a film that he'd put together with some high water shots from 1957. Does that ring a bell at all?
Vaguely, but I don't remember it well.
Okay. And I think, go ahead.
You know, at that time, during that time, or maybe overlapping with it, I worked with Tim Crumbo, and he wrote a history book on Grand Canyon.
Right.
And so he was so strong on history, human history, that and he was very much into it. And so a lot of that I kind of left to him because he just you know, he did so much of the research, he had so much more knowledge.
Yeah, right. What can you tell me about Kim?
Well, Kim Crumbo is truly a larger-than-life person. You know, he was kind of a boatman's boatman. Have you ever met him?
Oh, yes.
Right, so, you know, he's about 5'7" tall, about 5'7" wide, and and unbelievably strong, but also extremely kind and very smart and very passionate about natural history in general and the Grand Canyon in specific. And fascinating to talk to the extent that he would about his life as a SEAL.
Mm-hmm.
And, gosh, you know, just feel super privileged to have worked with him, bluntly put, yeah.
Cool. Okay. So you and Sam West are doing kayak patrol trips.
Yeah.
Were you on in the river unit when they were still running the dories? Did you or was that just before you?
No, dories. We bought the dories in my tenure. Yeah.
Can you tell me about that story? How did that work out? Or not?
You know, I wasn't really all that involved with them. I don't even think I ran one very much. We worked on them a lot.
You mean as like repairing them after they got broken?
Yeah.
Uh huh. They're kind of fussy, aren't they?
Oh yeah, you ever watch? Have you been down the river very much?
Uh-huh.
Have you watched dory boatman park in Havasu Canyon?
Don't touch my boat.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Huh. Okay. So that must have been a learning experience.
Yeah. I don't remember. I don't remember. Maybe it was Sam. Somebody really liked to hang out in the boat shop and just work on boats all night, all day, you know, during the winter. So I don't remember who that was, but everybody kind of got to do what they liked, so that was fine.
And the boat shop at the time was, the Park Service has gone through three maintenance yards. The original maintenance yard wasn't far from the Babbitt store and the Ranger Operations Building.
Yeah.
And that's where the boat shop was. Is that right in there? Is that how you remember it?
The Ranger Op business building was where our offices were.
Okay.
And then the boat shop was a smaller, single, freestanding building, and it was across from something that had been, I just don't remember if it was like a very old maintenance building.
Right.
But yeah, it was kind of in that, don't remember.
Okay. And by this time, as a technician, are you on permanently?
I got on permanently somewhere in that transition, maybe 83, maybe before, maybe after.
Okay.
But I was a 10-month technician.
Did you think about going to law enforcement training? Did that happen?
Oh, yeah. I got on permanent status, and I got sent to SLEPSI to get a law enforcement commission. Uh-huh.
So that's the Federal Law Enforcement Training Academy in Georgia, is that right?
Yep, in Georgia, yep.
And when did you go through that training?
That might have been 83, 84, somewhere in there.
Okay. And that should have gotten you into a better pay grade.
You know, we were kind of not fishing that foul. The river unit fell under the protection side of things, right? So I came back to the commission, and supposedly we were supposed to be running backcountry patrols, and at the time, you know, the NTS 9 requirements were that, you know, backcountry would be their defensive weapons and stuff. And, I mean, that was kind of a joke. I remember we had a lot of backcountry rangers who would hike down and meet us, ride with us for a couple of days, and then hike out and do their patrols that way. And, you know, the spiel was they come down, they take off their pack, we would pack all their stuff in river bags, and the last thing they would pull out of their backpack was this little snub-nosed 38 service revolver, right?
Right.
Part of your, what you were required to carry, but it's in the bottom of the pack, so it's heavy, and it's covered with Gatorade powder. And
right. Yeah. And it's also, you know, it's a fascinating public relations journey when you are in the backcountry and you show up with a sidearm exposed on your hip versus, you know, in the bottom of the pack with the Gatorade all over it.
Well, you know, I think most of those backcountry guys were sensitive enough to the fact that, you know, in Grand Canyon, in that time, that's when there were a couple good qualifiers, on a backcountry trail, having your 38 on you would have been a little inappropriate. But I do remember, hang on a minute. Let me go put my phone on the charger. You know, Dave Bocello at that time was running Phantom Ranch, and he had a little bit higher profile law enforcement-wise, and he was always, you know, he was the backcountry ranger in Phantom Ranch, and he was always wearing his weapon. And I remember doing I got sent down to Eden Gardens one night, or a couple, you know, hey, you go do a detail, go be a ranger at Phantom, Indian Springs, which was great. And, you know, I remember some guys came to my little ranger house and knocked on the door, like, 11 o'clock at night, and you know, they looked like something out of Deliverance. They had mustard-flavored sardines all over their faces, and they were scary, and I just thought, good day to have a service weapon on you.
Mm-hmm.
You boys go away now.
Right.
So,
yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah. Interesting.
I have a funny, this is a little bit offside.
Yeah.
I have a funny Larry Van Slyke story. You talked to Larry, right?
Not yet.
So many years later, we went to see Larry Van Slyke. My husband was alive at the time, and he was district ranger at Canyonlands. And at the time, militia people were threatening to kill park rangers and were leaving threats that we're not leaving here until the Virgin River runs bloody. And Larry's a pretty slight guy, and he's in his office, and he's bringing in what looks like on a hand cart with what looks like a bunch of books and boxes. It was obviously very heavy, and I said, Larry, don't you have underlings to do stuff like that for you? Because the Park Service is pretty militaristic, you know, in a lot of ways. And he said, oh, well, it's not books. And he picks one out and shows it to me, and it was ceramic core flakjack barriers. You know, so if you were shot by a militia guy, if you had your ceramic core flakjack barrier, you're not going to get dead, because they were using, you know, coming after the park rangers with hollow points. So
wow.
It's kind of the flip side of,
yeah,
you know, so... Why? Well, that's the other side of the why do park rangers, why are park rangers armed? So.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yep. That's right. Yeah. What do you remember about Kurt Sauer?
Oh, you know, Kurt was a wonderful boss. Kurt taught me a lot. I was always very close with, Kurt and I were boss and employee, but we were also friends, or are still friends. I just went to his wedding 15 months ago, whenever.
Cool.
Kurt was very ambitious in the Park Service, destined to do well, and did, and was just intelligent and grateful, good with people. Yeah, I, you know, hard to talk about the living. Kurt came to the river, and at that time the river unit was kind of made up of river people. They were hiring guys out of the river business, and Kurt was a Park Service person. And at the time, not everything was sort of hunky-dory, bringing in outside Park Service people to our sick little river unit. And Kurt fit in really well and learned to row, and also was Park Service enough to deal with the outfitters, which was a huge part of that job, but also flexible enough and mentioned enough of the guy to fit in and work with the river community in general. So, yeah. Kurt's a ton of respect for Kurt. Great friend. And, I was very, not crushed, but just not very sad when he left. You know, he, like all good Park Service people, got a promotion, or applied for it, and got a promotion to a better job. I think it was Cafe at the time, and ended up having a very prestigious Park Service career, as he should have. So,
Yeah. He mentioned. Sorry, we've been going about an hour here. Is this a good time to? To wrap this up, and we'll come back and give it another shot on another day. All right. Well, with that, let's go ahead and wrap up what will be part one of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Kim Johnson. Today is Monday, October 12th, 2020. My name is Tom Martin. And Kim, thank you so very much.
You're welcome, Tom. It was a pleasure. You're a good interviewer.